Chapter 6. High above the earth, the phoenix soared, a noble bird, much like an eagle, save for the reddish tint to its golden feathers and the iridescent flecks on the tips of its outstretched wings. It had a crest the colour of brass, claws like hooks of gold, and jet-black eyes that looked forward and back across eternity. It also had a narked expression, and was carrying a quarter ton of artichokes in a big string net. Now, the great weight wasn't the only thing that annoyed me about this job. The early start had been a pain in the plumage, too. I'd had to set off shortly after midnight to get from Israel to the northern coast of Africa, where the finest wild artichokes grew. Just so, and here I quote the specific terms of my charge, I could pick the juiciest specimens in the crystal dews of dawn. I ask you, as if it made a blind bit of difference. Digging up the wretched things had been tiresome enough as well. I was going to have soil stuck beneath my claws for weeks, and carrying them back 1,500 miles into a mild headwind hadn't been a picnic either. But I could cope with all this. What really stuck in my fiery craw were the amused chuckles and wry expressions I was getting from my fellow spirits as I neared Jerusalem. Grinning broadly, they flitted past me through the air, splendid and warlike, carrying their shimmering spears and swords. They were off hunting for brigands in the desert wastes, a decent mission worthy of the name. Me, I trundled slowly north with my bag of groceries, wearing a forced smile and muttering salty insults under my breath, which I'm certainly not going to repeat here. Unlike some lesser jinn I could name, who rejoice in vulgarisms and inappropriate analogies, I'm a stickler for propriety. Always have been. Famous for it. In fact, you could tattoo what I don't know about good taste on the backside of a midget, assuming you hold him down hard enough to stop him squirming. I was being punished, you see, and it frankly wasn't fair. Ordinarily, when you kill a magician with a bit of honest trickery and escape back to the other place, you're likely to be left in peace for a while. A few years pass by, maybe a decade or two, and then finally another avaricious chancer who's learned a bit of old Sumerian and worked out how to draw a pentacle without too many wonky lines will locate your name, summon you back, and start your slavery anew. But at least when that happens, the rules are clear and tacitly acknowledged by both parties. The magician forces you to help him get wealth and power, and you do your best to find a way to nobble him. Tomb-building, treasure-hunting, battle-fighting, artichoke-collecting? Outwardly different, maybe, but in the end all magicians' demands boil down to wealth and power, whatever they might claim. Sometimes you succeed, and more often than not, you don't. It all depends on the skill and judgment of both sides. But it's a personal duel, and if you score a rare victory over your oppressor, the last thing you expect is to be brought back instantly and punished for that victory by someone else. Yet that was exactly the way things worked in Solomon's Jerusalem. Not 24 hours after devouring the old magician and departing his tower with a burp and a smile, I'd been summoned back to another tower, farther along the city wall. Before I could so much as open my mouth to protest, I'd been rattled with a spasm, whirled, pressed, flipped, and stretched, and finally given a good hard stippling for my trouble. Spasms, whirls, stipples, etc. Punitive spells frequently employed to keep a healthy young jinni in line. Painful, tedious, usually non-fatal. You might think, after all that, I'd have been given a moment to pass a few acerbic remarks, but no. An instant later, I found myself packed off on the first of many degrading missions, all specifically designed to break my carefree spirit. It was a depressing list. First, I was sent to Mount Lebanon to chip blue ice from its summit so the king's sherbets would be nicely chilled. Next, I was ordered to the palace granaries to count the grains of barley for the annual stock-taking. After that, I was employed in Solomon's gardens to pluck dead leaves from the trees and flowers so that nothing brown or shriveled might offend the royal eye. Then there followed an unpleasant 2 days in the palace sewers, over which I draw a slightly soiled veil, before a taxing expedition in search of a fresh roc's egg for the royal household's breakfast. Gourmet's note. One roc's egg, scrambled, feeds roughly 700 wives, provided you mix in a few vats of milk and a churn or three of butter. I had to whisk the thing as well, which gave me a sore elbow. And now, if all that wasn't enough, I'd been saddled with this currant artichoke fest, which was making me a laughingstock in the eyes of my fellow gin. None of this broke my spirit, naturally, but it didn't half make me irritable. And you know who I blamed it all on? Solomon. Not that he was the one who summoned me, of course. He was much too important for that. So important, in fact, that in the 3 long years I'd spent enslaved in the city, I'd scarcely set eyes on him. Although I'd hung about the palace a fair bit, exploring its mile-wide maze of halls and pleasure gardens, I'd only once or twice seen the king in the distance, surrounded by a gaggle of squalling wives. He didn't get out much. Apart from his daily councils, to which I wasn't invited, he passed most of his time cooped up in his private apartments beyond the northern gardens. And while he lolled about up there, pampering himself, day-to-day summonings were delegated to his 17 top magicians, who dwelt in the towers strung along the city walls. It hadn't always been that way, if you could believe the stories. Long-serving Jin reported that in the early years of his reign, Solomon enjoyed regular banquets and masks and entertainments of every conceivable kind, though gurning and juggling always featured prominently. Each night, garlands of imp lights would illuminate the cypress trees, and roving spirit globes bathed the palace in 1,000 shifting colours. Solomon, his wives, and his courtiers would frolic upon the lawns while he worked wonders for them with his ring. Times, it seemed, had changed since then. My previous master had been one of the 17, and my new master was also, and this, in a nutshell, was proof of Solomon's power. All magicians are by nature bitter rivals. When one of them is killed, their instinct is to rejoice. In fact, they're more likely to summon up the offending jinni to shake him heartily by the claw than to work any punishment upon him. But not in Solomon's Jerusalem. The king treated the demise of one of his servants as a personal slight, and demanded retribution. And so it was that, against all laws of natural justice, here I was, enslaved again. Scowling furiously at my misfortunes, I drifted onward in the warm, dry winds. Far below me, my fiery shadow flitted over olive groves and barley fields, and dropped and skimmed down steep terraces of fig. Stage by stage, Solomon's little kingdom rolled out beneath me, until in the distance I saw the rooftops of his capital, scattered like glittering fish scales on its hill. A few years previously, Jerusalem had been a dowdy little town, not especially notable, and certainly not to be compared with capitals such as Nimrud, Babylon, or Thebes. Now it vied with those ancient cities as a place of wealth and splendour, and the reason for this wasn't hard to guess. It was all about the ring. The ring. That was at the heart of it all. That was why Jerusalem flourished. That was why my masters jumped at Solomon's command. That was why so many magicians congregated around him in the first place, like bloated fleas on a leper's dog, like moths around a flame. It was, thanks entirely to the ring he wore upon his finger, that Solomon enjoyed his life of indolence and Israel its unparalleled prosperity. It was thanks to the ring's sinister reputation that the once great empires of Egypt and Babylon now kept their wary distance and watched their frontiers with anxious eyes. It was all about the ring. Personally speaking, I hadn't actually seen this benighted artifact close up, but then again I hadn't needed to. Even from a distance I understood its power. All magical objects emit an aura, and the more powerful they are, the brighter that aura is. Once, when Solomon had passed me in the distance, I'd briefly checked the higher planes. The flow of light made me cry out in pain. Something on his person glowed so fearsomely he was almost blotted out. It was like staring into the sun. From what I'd heard, the thing itself wasn't actually much to look at. Just a yellow band inlaid with a single gem of black obsidian. But Stora said it contained a spirit of supreme power, who was brought forth whenever the ring was turned upon the finger. Merely touching the ring, meanwhile, summoned a retinue of marids, afrits, and jinn to serve the wearer's will. In other words, it was a portable gateway to the other place, through which almost unlimited numbers of spirits could be drawn. As well as all this, the ring was said to protect Solomon from magical attack, give him extraordinary personal allure, which possibly explained all those wives cluttering up the place, and allow him to understand the language of birds and animals. Not bad, in short, though the last one isn't half as useful as you might expect, since when all's said and done, the language of the beasts tends to revolve around A, the endless hunt for food, B, finding a warm bush to sleep in of an evening, and C, the sporadic satisfaction of certain glands. Many would argue that the language of humankind boils down to this too. Elements such as nobility, humour, and poetry of the soul are conspicuously lacking. You have to come to middle-ranking jinn for them. Solomon had access to this awful power on a moment's whim, and without personal danger. The usual rigours of the magician's trade were unknown to him. No fiddling with candles or getting chalky knees, no chance of getting fried, roasted, or plain old eaten, and no chance either of being murdered by rivals or discontented slaves. In one place a slight scratch was said to mar the ring. This was where the great married Azul, taking advantage of an ambiguity in his master's phrasing, had attempted to destroy it while carrying Solomon by carpet from Lachish to Beth-Zur. Azul's petrified form, worn ever thinner by the desert winds, now stood in lonely isolation above the Lachish road. Earlier in his reign, two other marrieds, Philocrates and Odalis, had also tried to slay the king. Their subsequent careers were similarly melancholy. Philocrates became an echo in a copper pot, and Odalis a startled face etched into a floor tile in the royal bathroom. Many such stories were told about the ring, and it was no surprise that Solomon lived a cushy life as a result. The sheer power and dread exerted by that scrap of gold upon his finger kept all his magicians and their spirits nicely in line, thank you. The threat of its use hovered over us all. Noon came. My journey was at an end. I crossed high above the Kidron Gate, above the teeming markets and bazaars, and finally swung low over the palace and its gardens. In these last few moments my burden felt particularly heavy, and it was fortunate for Solomon that he wasn't at that moment promenading along his gravel walkways. If I'd seen him, I'd have been sorely tempted to zoom down and offload my cargo of ripe artichokes directly on his preening head before chasing his wives into the fountains. But all was still. The phoenix continued sedately to its appointed landing site, namely a scrappy compound at the back end of the palace, where sour smells rose from the slaughtering sheds, and the gates to the kitchens were always open. I descended swiftly, dropped my burden to the ground, and alighted, taking the form of a handsome youth, as I did so. It was the guise I'd worn when I was spear-bearer to Gilgamesh 2,000 years before. A tall, beautiful young man, smooth-skinned and almond-eyed. He wore a long, wrapped skirt, necklaces of amethyst on his breast, and ringlets in his hair, and had about him an air of wistful grace that contrasted pungently with the foul detritus of the kitchen yard. I often used this form in such circumstances. It made me feel better, somehow. A band of imps scampered forward, ready to carry my net toward the kitchen. Stalking alongside came a plump, jinny overseer, long papyrus scrolls in hand. "You're late," he exclaimed. "All banquet deliveries were due by noon." I squinted at the heavens. "It is noon, Bosquo. Look at the sun."
"Noon is precisely 2 minutes gone," the jinny said. "You, sir, are late. However, we will overlook it just this once. Your name?"
"Bartimaeus, bringing artichokes from the Atlas Mountains.
"A moment, a moment. We have so many slaves." The Jinni took a stylus from behind his ear and buried himself in his scrolls. Aleph. Bet. Where's the bet scroll? These modern languages. There's no logic to them. Ah, here. He looked up. Right. Yes. Name again. I tapped a sandal upon the ground. Bartimaeus. Bosquo consulted the scroll. Bartimaeus of Gilat? No. Bartimaeus of Tel Batash? No. The scroll was unfurled still further. There was a long pause. Bartimaeus of Kirbet Delhamir? No. Where in Marduk's name is that? Bartimaeus of Uruk, also known as Sakr al-Jinni, famous confidant of Gilgamesh and Akhenaten, and, for a time, Nefertiti's most trusted Jinni. The overseer looked up. Oh, it's Jinn we're talking about. This is the Foliot List. The Foliot List? I gave a cry of rage. What are you holding that for?
Well, to look at you.
Oh, hush.
Don't make such a squalling. Yes, yes, I have located you now. You are one of Karba's troublemakers, are you not? Trust me, your long-departed glories will count for little with him.
Bosquo broke off to issue orders to the imps, while I restrained the urge to swallow him, scrolls and all. I shook my head grimly. The only good thing about the whole embarrassing exchange was that no one else had witnessed it. I turned away. Hello, Bartimaeus. To find myself standing face to face with a stocky, pot-bellied Nubian slave. He was bald of head and red of eye, and sported a leopard-skin skirt with a large machete tucked in the waistband. He also wore 7 ivory torques about his thick bull neck, and a familiar expression of sardonic mirth. I winced. "Hello, Fakwal." "There you are, you see," the Jinni Fakwal said. "I still recognize you. Your ancient greatness is not yet quite forgotten. And do not give up hope. Perhaps one day the ballad of the artichokes will be sung about the hearth fires too, and your legend will live on." I scowled at him. "What do you want?" The Nubian indicated over his swarthy shoulder. "Our delightful master requires the whole company to assemble on the hill behind the palace. You're the last to arrive." "The day just keeps getting better and better," I said sourly. "All right, let's go." The handsome youth and the short, squat Nubian walked together across the yard, and those lesser spirits we met, observing our true natures on the higher plains, hopped hurriedly aside. At the rear gate, vigilant demi-afrits, with flies' eyes and the ears of bats, noted our names and numbers and checked our identities against further scrolls. We were ushered through and presently came out on an area of rough ground on the edge of the hill, with the city shimmering below. Not far away, 6 other spirits stood waiting in a line. My recent assignments having all been solitary ones, it was the first time I'd seen my fellow offending jinn together, and I scrutinized them closely. "As revolting a group of ne'er-do-wells as have ever been assembled," Fakwal remarked. "And that was before you arrived. Not just hideous, either. Each and every one of us has killed or maimed his previous master, or, in the case of Khosroes, roundly insulted her with the harshest possible language. We are a grim and dangerous company." Some of the spirits, like Fakwal, I'd known and disliked for years. Others were new to me. All had adopted human guises on the first plane, their bodies in more or less correct proportions. Most had muscular torsos and sculpted limbs, though none quite as sculpted as mine. One or two had chosen bandy legs and plump, protruding bellies. All were dressed in the simple, rough-spun skirts of the typical male slave. As we drew close, however, I noticed that even here each of the renegade jinn had subtly undermined his human shape by adding a small demonic detail. Some had horns peeping through their hair. Others had tails, large pointed ears, or cloven hooves.
The insubordination was risky, but stylish. Solomon's edicts dictated that ordinary human shapes were maintained at all times outside the palace walls. Animals were forbidden, likewise mythic beasts. Grotesque deformities were out too, which was a shame. The idea was to prevent the common people being startled by repulsive sights, such as Beza taking a stroll with his limbs on back to front, or, admittedly, yours truly, forgetfully popping out to buy some figs in the guise of a rotting corpse, thus causing the great fruit market terror, 15 deaths in the associated stampede, and the destruction of half the commercial district. Got my figs dirt cheap, mind, so it wasn't all bad. I decided to join in and allow two small ram's horns to curl out on my brow. Fakwal, I noticed, had given his Nubian an elegant set of nicely filed fangs. Thus beautified, we took our places in the line. We waited. A hot wind blew upon the hilltop. Far to the west, clouds were massing above the sea. I shifted from foot to foot and yawned. "Well," I said, "is he coming or not? I'm bored, I'm knackered, and I could do with an imp. In fact, I saw some back in the yard that wouldn't be missed if we were quiet about it. If we got a little bag," my neighbour nudged me.
"Hush,"
he hissed. "Oh, come on, what's so bad about that? We all do it."
"Hush,"
he snapped.
"He's here."
I stiffened. At my side, seven other djinn sprang to swift attention. We all stared glassily above our heads. A figure in black came up the hill, his shadow stretching long and thin behind him.